The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Welcome to another episode of Kotaku Split Screen, the only podcast where none of the characters interact with one another. It's July 11th, 2018, and Kirk's off this week, so today I'm bringing on Kotaku's Tim Rogers to pretend to be him. We're going to talk about jazz, Dark Souls, and all the other things that Kirk loves. Just kidding, we're actually talking about Octopath Traveler, old-school JRPGs, and then some spoilerific dissection of The Sopranos, the greatest television show of all time. Seriously, I mean, move over the wire or whatever. The Sopranos just beats everything. Anyway, it's going to be a good one. Let's go. We are back for another episode. My name is Jason Schreier. I am the news editor at Kotaku.com, and I am joined not by Kirk Hamilton.
What?
But instead by Kotaku's own video producer, Tim Rogers. Hello, Tim.
Hello. I didn't know Kirk Hamilton wasn't going to be here.
Yeah, I know. I really pulled a fast one on you.
What the heck?
I was like, come on split screen, and you're like, yeah, I want to talk to Jason and Kirk. And then I was like, this is awkward.
I thought I was going to just be the third guy, and I was going to be able to just not talk that much.
And just play threes on your phone the whole time.
Yeah, threes. No, I would be playing Octopath Traveler on my Nintendo Switch, because for me, it feels kind of the same brain gap as threes.
Oh, interesting. Well, we'll talk about that. We'll get to that. Yeah. But first, for people who aren't familiar, and I know many people are familiar with the one and only Tim Rogers. You've been at Kotaku for what, a year now?
Formally, I've been paying my rent with Kotaku for 1 year.
But you have really been around in the vicinity of Kotaku for a lot longer than that.
Since, like, shortly before the beginning. Shortly before, and formally, as a freelancer, shortly after the beginning, I guess.
Okay.
I was there.
When were you there before the beginning?
I just knew a bunch of those dudes, those Kotaku dudes. You know, the ones who are all, where are they? You know, where are they now?
Where are they now?
Yeah, some of them aren't there anymore.
The pre-Crescente era of Kotaku.
Yeah, yeah. I was, I wanted to use, for some reason, the word aplomb. Occurred to me. I wanted to. My brain occasionally gives me words. It's like use this word in the next sentence. And then I really wish I could have used the word aplomb.
But you cannot.
I was aplomb of video game blogs at that time.
Okay. Got it.
missed opportunity.
you were a plum writer that we picked.
Yes.
From the video game blog farms to come work for us and make videos for us.
Bunch of weird trash, yeah.
You also have a long history writing about games, making videos about games, and even making games. You made Video Ball, among other things.
Video Ball is so good.
It's a video ball is a video game in which you play with a ball.
Yeah, or three balls, actually, three is balls. The regulation play. Because why not?
Yeah, exactly.
Real sports can't do three balls.
So, Tim, today we're going to talk about a few different things. But first, we got to talk about Octopath Traveler.
So you're saying it's Octopath Traveler, O'Clocktopath Traveler?
It is. It's 8 o'clock, which means that it's time for Octopath Traveler.
Octoclock.
It is Octoclock time. It is time to talk about Octopi Traveler, which is, of course, a JRPG for the Switch that comes out on Friday. You and I have both been playing.
Yes.
By the time you are listening to this, this episode will actually go up a little bit later than usual on Thursday in order to make sure we're clear of the review embargo.
So actually,
at the second that this episode will hit people's download ears, my review will be up on Kotaku.com. So you can go read that for all of my final thoughts. But first of all, Tim, how much of Octopath Traveler have you played?
Octopath Traveler. So I've played a total of about 30 hours.
Okay.
But playing a video game for me is, I guess, different than playing it for a review. So, okay, there's two ways I play video games. First of all, it's for fun. No, there's three ways. Mm-hmm. First of all, it's for fun. Second of all, is for research. I try to play everything just to know.
Right.
Like just a little bit of everything. If I get a code for something or I get a free copy of something or somebody loans me something, I'll try to play it. If there's a demo of something, I'll try to give it 20 minutes,
just
30
minutes. Just to increase your library of knowledge.
Just to be able to make a reference. You know,
feed it to the brain.
Imagine party conversation. Mm-hmm. Somebody brings up, I don't know, what's that Shadow of Mordor game or whatever. Like, oh, you know, press the X button to hug your wife or whatever.
Right.
Right. So it's like, you know, you gotta be able to know at least one little.
You got to know all the references.
Superficial quip.
So you can meme it up with people.
Yeah, just to be able to. And again, I'm saying I imagine party conversations.
But when you say you played 30 hours of Octopath Traveler, you're talking about starting the game a lot from the beginning.
Yeah, there's work playing. So there's the research playing, 20 minutes or so of a game. Then there's the fun playing, by which I've played Dragon Quest XI for about 200 hours in the last year.
And then that will be for work later.
That's going to be a fourth type of playing that we'll get into at some other point. So Octopath is played for making a video. And in case you didn't know, making a video of a video game is it's a lot of work. It's okay. I don't want to complain about work that pays me well enough to live, but it's not like playing a video game at all.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sitting there and I'm playing through these. I played all the prologue chapters of Octopath Traveler because I wanted all of them cleanly captured. And it's like you're playing them with the music turned off and you're sitting on your sofa and you're playing and you're just making sure, because when you watch footage of yourself playing a game, just any game, and you're trying to make one of these videos that, you know, I take it upon myself to make them very meticulously, like Swiss watches or whatever. So when you're watching your own footage of the game and you see your guy, you know, just like running down a hallway and you're like, oh, this is good B-roll. And then for some reason you stop.
Right.
Because you're looking at your phone in real life and the guy's just standing there.
Got to check Twitter. Right.
And you're just like, oh, what was I doing
for
this 5 seconds? Did someone distract me? Did something happen? And it's like, we'll never know. But that clip is not as cleanly usable. It doesn't fit. Like, my sentence is an exact length. So it's like my clip is like this long, and then the
sentence. Nobody can see what you're doing with
your hands. I'm holding my fingers a couple of inches apart. My clip is about 2 inches long on the screen, and then my voice clip is about 2.2 inches long.
Right.
So it's like, oh, if only this clip was good enough to just match this whole sentence.
Mm.
I don't want to cut to another clip in the middle of a sentence, so maybe I can find something else.
Uh-huh.
And it's not as relevant as this perfect thing. So I'm playing Octopath Traveler with my headphones on and my eyes just straight on the screen on my big TV on a day off on the 4th of July, right? And I'm just like, this is my first experience with this game that looks like, I mean, it looks like just cotton candy for Final Fantasy VI fans, you know? And it's like, I want to eat it all. And it's like, no, I got to make sure my guy's walking. Like, I want to do a clean circuit of the town at the end of the video so that my guy's walking. And, you know, I accidentally brush close to an NPC and the little press a button to talk to him dialogue pops
so
up.
Do you feel like this has made you enjoy the game less because you had to play it in such a strange way?
Oh, weirdly, no, because once I got all the footage that I wanted, which was every prologue chapter by itself, and then I stuck with Tressa and I recorded just, you know, like I recorded getting three characters as Tressa,
mm-hmm.
and I used that footage as well in my video. Once I finished with that, for the first time in my experience with the game, I took it out of the dock and I just grinded
and
a little bit.
And you played it for real.
Yeah, and I'm like, oh man, these battles are so good.
So how far did you get for real when you were playing for real?
I have just started. I've just gotten all 8 characters and I've just started Tressa's
chapter
2. You're
starting chapter 2. Okay.
Yeah,
so let me explain a little bit of context here. So the way that this game works is that it tells 8 different stories and they're all totally standalone stories. They function as if you don't have anyone in your party except for that character. And you can progress in them in any order. So you can either do all the chapter 1s, then all the chapter 2s, then all the chapter 3s, or do them in whatever order you want. If you really wanted and you had a Death Wish or something, you could just stick with one character and solo their entire chapter, although the combat is much less fun with only one character.
When you posted that in your video,
you saw it as a challenge.
In your post, no, I had actually already started that.
A solo run?
I started a solo as Ophelia to see what it was like.
Great.
And it's interesting, but not... I mean, the battles scale up. There's, you know, they get harder the more people you have in your party. So.
Well, no, that's only for the chapter ones.
And the chapter twos are
the
just
chapter
wild.
Twos, they all have static level requirements. So that'll be like in the 20s. And then the chapter threes are all in the 30s. And the chapter fours are all level 45, no matter how many people you have or whatever. So it's just the chapter ones that are scaling. And other than that, it's like a turn-based JRPG. Yeah, so it's got that nonlinear structure. And turn-based JRPG, the battle system is really interesting. We'll get to that in a second. But first, I want to talk about my biggest gripe, and maybe you noticed this.
Oh, yeah. It might be mine, too, so this is interesting.
My biggest gripe is that every single chapter, there are 32 chapters in the game.
32 chapters?
Well, no.
Four
for each character.
Oh, okay. I was suddenly getting excited.
No,
like...
yeah. No, it's not that long. So four chapters for each character. I beat them all. I beat all eight of them, all 32 chapters in about 36 hours.
36 hours.
Yeah. So each chapter, with one exception, so 31 of them, are all exactly the same. You get to a town, you watch some cutscenes, you go to a dungeon, fight through the dungeon, hit the boss, beat a boss, end of chapter.
Yeah.
That's 31 of them are exactly the same. Every single dungeon is exactly the same. There's one main path, and then there's some side paths and
to get the
like
treasure
branches,
chests.
And those all lead to treasure chests. Other than that, every single dungeon is exactly the same.
It's sometimes hard to see what the side path is, though.
You got to give it that.
The weird perspective and the tilt shift and the strange focus makes
very
it
true. And the lighting.
Sometimes hard to the lighting makes it hard to get to the treasure chests.
No obstacles, no mazes, no puzzles, nothing.
Yeah.
And every single boss fight is also pretty much exactly the same. For example, in every single chapter two, it's always one boss with two minions, and in order to make the boss vulnerable, you have to take out the two minions.
Uh-huh.
Every single chapter two is like that. So it might be the most repetitive game I've ever played in that sense. And you might be listening to this and thinking, oh, Jason, it's a JRPG. Of course it's repetitive. But no, this is like goes well beyond what you would expect.
Yeah.
So that's my biggest gripe. What were you going to say? Is there a
I played all eight of the prologues immediately. I mean, first of all, don't feel compelled if you're listening to this. Don't feel compelled to play all eight prologues because
don't feel compelled to play this game at all because it's not that great.
It's not super great. It is 100% essential for me because for reasons we'll get into in a minute, because I'm a bit of a weirdo who likes JRPG battle systems.
The battle system is fantastic.
And this one is incredibly good, and that puts it up in the upper echelon, weirdly.
But, well, it makes the moment-to-moment gameplay a lot more enjoyable, when everything's so repetitive, because you know the fights are going to be fun. At least there's that.
So I played all eight of those chapters, one right after another, and if you're playing them in the course of a natural game, you pick one character, and you then you walk through the world kind of collecting the other, you know, just kind of stringing them together.
Yeah.
And
it's all a big circle, the way that you can walk around. All those chapter ones.
It's a clock. It's an octo clock.
It is.
So you basically scavenge all these characters, Octopath Scavenger, and you get like a little buffer between your character's prologue and the next. You get like a 20 minutes of questing through the wilderness to get to the town.
Uh-huh.
But if you do what I did, which is can't like quit the game or quit the title, then restart and just play the next prologue, you get no buffer, and the very cardboard cutout-y structure of the story segments really just kind of jumps out at you.
Well, it'll jump out at you no matter how you play it, I would say.
Yeah, I don't think there's one
story. But what you
did,
you started different save files.
So
you don't have to do that. You can see it all in one single save file.
Exactly. If you just go through the buffer, through the wilderness, get to the next person, and then it'll say, do you want to see their story? And you can say yes if you're just feeling wild and you want to see their story. So all of their stories are... After just watching all of them for capture and leaving the text box on the screen long enough that I can use it naturally in my video, I was just – I got like four in before I was just like, oh, man, I was so exhausted with the writing quality.
Mm-hmm.
And then not just the writing quality, but then just kind of basically knowing exactly what the loop of the game is. And it's like, there's not going to be anything for me here plot-wise that is like exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And it's every single prologue proceeded exactly as I could have predicted.
Right. They're all extremely trite.
No twist. It's you know those tweets where it's like, you know, the fake tweets where it's like, I made a bot watch 10,000 uh-huh. hours of Snickers commercials. Uh-huh. Here's the Palm Pilot commercial it wrote, you know? This, like, pretty much, these stories are a bot reading 10,000 pages of genre fantasy fiction and writing a story.
Every single JRPG ever made.
Yeah, it's... I mean,
you have the thief who lost his partner, whose partner betrayed him. You have the
shadow of Final Fantasy VI.
You have the knight whose liege lord was slain.
The Cyan, Final Fantasy VI.
You have the cleric who has to go on, the priest who has to go on a quest. She's
like a combination Terra, Celis, Rosa kind of character.
Yeah, but the difference is, I think, is that in a game in Final Fantasy VI, which is kind of, I think. Pretty much, I mean, it's like the holy grail for what you want your classic JRPG to be like.
It's the gold standard.
In that game, it's just shifting up. The moment-to-moment gameplay of the battle system never really changes, but it changes things. That shifts the structure up on you so much from a minute-by-minute basis that, like, one moment you're, like, riding this train that carries souls of the dead to another realm, and the next moment you're falling down a waterfall or, like, fighting off soldiers by splitting your party into three and going through mazes. And there's all these interesting structural techniques that it plays around with, and that makes the game feel a lot more interesting than Octopath Traveler ever does. The other problem with that story structure is not just that they're all cliches, which they are, and that never stops. Some of the stories...
I could tell it's never going to stop. I haven't beaten any of them
yet. I like Tressa. Tressa's is actually my favorite story.
Because
hers is refreshingly interesting and new, and it's not like, I'm going to go save the world. I want to go make money.
She's a merchant like Torneko in Dragon Quest IV.
Exactly.
So, which is another game that lets you choose from characters who then meet. So...
Yes, except in this one, they never really meet. There's no like overlapping, intersecting. Well, that's the thing. It's like there's no real narrative hook that ties the game together and makes you feel really invested. And
there's a narrative hook that gets you to buy the game, but it doesn't get you to... Oh, it just doesn't happen.
Yeah, and it's as you're playing and you're just slogging through this repetitive structure after, like, every single chapter is exactly the same, and you're going through them, and you're just like, it's so hard to care. And it's so unsettling that for each of these chapters, and you'll notice this the more and more you play, when you're going through a character's chapter, you only see that character in every single cutscene, and you won't see anybody else. So there are actually a couple of moments throughout the game where one of your where as part of the story, the main character of that story will get put in a jail or something like that, and you'll see a scene of them imprisoned, but nobody else in the party will be there for some reason, and it just seems, it all feels very disjointed. It's like one of the things I said in my review is that it's like Octopath Traveler feels like someone took pieces from 8 different Lego sets and just stuck them all together with no regard for how it would look or what the instructions actually said. And that's basically this game.
Yeah, that was so jarring for me, like so jarring on my very first, just the very first quest I did as Tressa. I went to get Ulbrich, and I just go to his town and I meet him, and the very first thing that happens is I talk to him and he's like, oh, so those bandits, they're terrible. Oh, you wayfaring sort, you look as though you may be helpful. And then, are you sure you want to join me, take upon my burden?
Mm-hmm.
Durst thou take upon my burden? And you just say, do you want to join Ulbrich? And you say, yes. And then you walk like literally like half a screen north, and there's a bunch of dudes on the stairs, and you go up there, and then the screen just fades out and then comes back, and Ulbrich is by himself, and he's like,
yep,
this is what I have to do, and I have to do it alone. And it's like, what? It's like, it's just like the other person has just disappeared. We have this perfunctory dialogue in which he says, are you sure you want to join me?
Uh-huh.
And you're just like, oh, yeah. And then it's not 3 seconds later, you've just been erased. Your protagonist has been just wiped off the screen, And then,
but they're still in your party, so it's like when you actually fight a battle, it's all of you together.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, so none of the characters interact during the actual story stuff, but then in between, there's these optional little vignettes. They're sort of like Tales-style vignettes where you press the plus button, and then you can see these one-on-one conversations. Sometimes there are a few people later in the game, but normally one-on-one. So it'll be like Ulbrich's Chapter 2, then he'll be able to have that little vignette with all three other people that are in your actual party. But they're all just boring and don't say anything useful and don't contribute to the plot, and it just has this very unsettling feeling that you know that this party of characters is traveling together, but none of them are actually engaging with what they're seeing. And also, like, some of their character quests are very urgent, like someone's a family member is kidnapped or someone else is on this desperate quest to save themselves from something. But instead, they'll just fuck around going around with all the other people and just, like, doing their other quests for no apparent reason. It's never really clear why they're all together.
That's always jarring in a game. Yeah, so it's like, you know, the reality TV show staple, the I'm not here to make friends? Mm-hmm. Octopath Traveler is a game where they don't even bother saying they're not here to make friends because they're just not.
They're here to make teammates.
Yeah, they're not friends.
They're not friends. They don't talk. They're not,
It's always jarring in an RPG when you can just do whatever you want instead of the pressing thing. Like, the key example... The marquee example would be the meteor in Final Fantasy VII.
Uh-huh.
You have 7 days before the world ends. And
but even that is like, buy that a little bit more than I can buy the fact that this pious priest would be traveling around the world with this rogue who's just loves stealing shit, and this murderous dancer who just wants revenge. Like, it really makes no sense. I feel like on the suspension of disbelief scale, maybe most JRPGs are like a 5 or a 6, and this is like a 10. It doesn't want you to believe it at all.
Yeah, it's weird.
And it's also
it's so grounded though.
Yeah.
It's got characters motivated by obtaining physical revenge against assassins.
Yep.
It's got characters who have these really naturalistic motivations, yet it's not actually written.
Yeah.
It's an outline.
It is. It does feel like an outline. And it's really too bad because you see a game that looks like this, like you said, it's like cotton candy for the eyes.
Yeah, it's like, I love it.
But it's just this visual feast. But and so when I originally saw this, and I've been like feverishly anticipating this game for a year and a half since it was first announced, because it looks like the Final Fantasy VI successor that everybody wants, but it's just so not. And it's so just something else entirely, something that really isn't that great. But let's talk about the one thing that is really great, which is the combat system.
And it's so great.
Brief description of the combat system.
Yeah.
Basically, every single character can use multiple different weapons, axes, swords, spears, and also different types of spells and elemental attacks, fire, wind, earth, dark, etc., etc. Every single enemy in the game, from regular mobs to bosses, has X number of weaknesses. It could be 1, it could be 2, it could be 6. And the way that you do serious damage to an enemy is not just to keep hitting them with whatever, it's to... hit them a certain number of times, and it varies per enemy, with that weakness, with whatever they're weak to, which breaks down their defenses and makes them vulnerable to attacks.
Yeah.
And as you'll see later in the game, this is actually, it gets really, really cool later because they play up the formula in some really interesting ways. Sometimes bosses will switch up their weaknesses mid-battle. Sometimes they'll have locks on certain weaknesses and you can only use some of them and not others. And the way to really do well in the game is to set yourself up for these combos by recognizing, okay, this character is going to act next, and then this one, so I'm going to break down the guy's defenses at this point, and then set up this super powerful combo to make Ulbrich do crazy amounts of damage, etc., etc. So there's a lot of strategy, and it makes even small battles feel really significant.
I just did a video here where I sort of randomly selected a 2-minute battle from all my footage, and then I talked over it, pausing and resuming, for it took me 13 minutes to explain all the little details that are going on in the battle system. And it's like, this is just a tiny grind battle. And it's like, it's a battle that I achieved an untouched victory on. It was not a domination victory, but it was an untouched, which means the enemies did not hit me. Despite it not being a surprise battle, it was, we both started on equal footing, and somehow I was able to stagger, freeze, anticipate. There was an enemy that I knew would do a buff on his first round, So I knew that I didn't have to break him, but I knew I had to get him close to being broken before his second round came up.
Uh-huh.
And it's just, it's really, really fascinating. The very first battle I played, which was as Alfin against a frog, and I the guy in the town told me to cast ice on him and then use an axe, right? It's like, oh, okay. It's like, it was kind of great because he's weak to both ice and axe. And you see next to an enemy's name a little shield logo.
Uh-huh.
That's how many shield points they have. So it's like, if an enemy has 3 shield points, you have to hit them with one of their weaknesses 3 times, right? So it does what I consider to be the best RPGs do, which is it requires you to guess a lot of the time. So there's no better feeling than encountering an enemy for the first time in this game, not knowing any of his weaknesses, and somehow achieving an untouched victory.
Mm-hmm.
That's really cool. Because
that's skill.
Yeah, because you manage to... It's skill at guessing. Which is a type of skill that...
Well, you can guess that if an enemy is a tree, they're probably going to be weak against axes.
Weak against axes and fire.
Yeah.
Yeah, usually, unless it's a redwood, which mm-hmm. they're fireproof.
Right, if you wind up in California, which is a large chunk of this game.
Yeah, California. Oh, those redwoods, man. That's axe only.
Ulbrich's story takes place entirely in California.
Yeah, the guy's he's a real man. It kind of does. It's just sort of Texas. He sort of starts in kind of a Texas. But these battles are so the real big thing is the boost points, right? So every round you get a boost point, and then you can use a boost point to boost one of your attacks mm-hmm. or abilities. Or in Ulbrich's case, you can boost his defense.
Mm-hmm.
So you can actually have up to 5 boost points at once. You can use up to 3 of them per turn. And then if you use them, you don't get one the next turn.
They're sort of like Braves in Bravely
Default.
They're
just like Braves. You can either Brave or you can Default.
Except there's no Default in this. There's only the positive part of that.
Yeah, because you're getting boost points no matter what unless you boost it. So,
well, actually, it gets even more interesting and complicated because you can actually get items that give you boost points in the middle of battle later. And there's all sorts of other interesting ways that you can play around with
it. That's why I was really, really intrigued by Tressa because I originally, first of all, I liked the character. She reminds me of Torneko from Dragon Quest IV.
Mm-hmm.
She even has a similar attitude. I was looking at her skills when I first got the skills and I saw one of her skills is donate BP. So you can give one of her boost points to someone else. Yeah. You spend 3 magic points.
It's actually, even though it's called Donate BP, I don't think she actually gives up one. I think she just hands one to someone without even losing one.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's... Well, yeah. Oh, okay. I guess she... Well, so I saw that.
I know. You would think.
My brain lit on fire when I saw
that. It
seems
like a bug or something. But yeah. Also, so later on, when you start getting into Chapter 2, you can go find all these shrines across the map where you unlock jobs. And basically, you unlock all the 8 core jobs. And then there are a few bonus ones that you can get much later in the game. But then that means you can add all the extra jobs to your character. So like mm-hmm. you can make Tressa, in addition to being a merchant, you can make her a dancer. Or you can make Ulbrich, in addition to being a warrior, you can make him a scholar and have him cast black magic or something. So there's a lot of cool creative combinations you can do. And the combat system is just phenomenal. Like I would play any other JRPG with the same exact like gameplay mechanics. The problem
I would love a straight up remake of Final Fantasy VI
with
just
this combat system. Oh my god, that would be incredible. But yeah, the problem is that everything else around it, the story, the structure, the grinding, the repetition, it all just fails so hard. The biggest problem, or one of the biggest problems, is that as you're playing, only your active 4 party members gain experience.
Uh-huh.
4 who are not with you don't. Yeah. So what that means is that essentially let's say you're doing all the chapter 2s for your main characters and then you want to bring in someone else who was on your bench before. They're going to be super underleveled, and it's not like they'll level up super quickly like Suikoden style where they'll catch up to you in 2 battles. It takes a while before they catch up.
It takes less than a million, but a lot more than 2 battles.
Yes. Yeah. And then especially if you're playing the way I did, which is basically I got everyone to chapter 2, so I beat all the chapter 1s, and then I took my 4 main party members and beat all their stories. So
who were your 4 mains?
So it was Tressa, Ulbrich, Cyrus was my main character, and then Ophelia. So I took the 4 of them, did all their 4
That's
of their
the Octo.
Did all 4 of their chapter 2s, did all 4 of their chapter 3s, did all 4 of their chapter 4s, and so they were like level 45, 46 by the end of their respective stories. And then I went back to clean up the other ones. And it took way longer than it should have, because each new character that I brought in would start off at like level 5 or something, which was fine when I was just doing their chapter 2. But eventually you have to keep, like, you have to actually get them to a decent level, or else you're just going to lose to the final boss of their story. And in some cases, they actually have to do like these one-on-one things. Like Therion the thief, he has to steal items from various characters as part of his ongoing story. Yeah. And his steal chances are based on his level. So if he's not at a high enough level in his chapter 4, you have like a 3% chance of stealing this item from this dude that you need to steal from. So your options are either grind, which could take 5 hours to get him to a high enough level, or keep stealing over and over again in hopes that eventually you'll hit that 3% shot, which is what I did. And it took me about like 40 tries to keep stealing, and eventually I got it.
Does your reputation in the town
suffer? The reputation doesn't actually matter, because you just go, like, when it ends, the reputation meter is basically whenever you use one of your characters, like, party actions.
Yeah.
If you're using one of the rogue ones, which is like Steel and some others, the game will tell you you have an X chance, or else your reputation in this town will suffer. And then you can basically do something 5 times, and then your reputation is shot, which means you can't use any more party actions. It's all like a red bar whenever you try to. But then you just walk to the bar and you pay them X amount of gold, and that's the end of it. I just had to pay him 1,000 gold, which was nothing.
Everybody trusts the bartender.
Yeah, it was very simple. Reputation system is kind of meaningless. The party actions are fun to play around with, but nothing special. And the combat system is great, but like the developers just, man, I just can't understand so many of the decisions that they made. And I was really craving like this incredible 16-bit style, classic style JRPG for the Switch, which would have been perfect, but this game is just not that.
I think they need to do a remake of Final Fantasy VI that just looks like
this. With the same art style. That's what everybody wants.
The same battle system is asking a lot, but also, wouldn't that be cool?
It would be cool, although I don't know. I would be totally fine with same battle system as 6, but this new art style remake, that would be incredible. But knowing them, they would just put like the mobile sprites in it. So
yeah. Man, you know it's going to happen. Like they released, Square Enix released Dragon Quest 1, 2, and 3 for the PlayStation 4, and it's just the mobile games just stretched out to a TV, and it looks god-awful. I bought them anyway, but it just looks terrible.
I do think that after the Chrono Trigger reception, which led to them like patching that game on PC like 4 or 5 times, I think that has opened some eyes over there, even in Japan.
Yeah. They need to treat these old games well. And it's like Octopath Traveler was really neat, because it looked like this gesture of, we're going to treat the idea of old RPGs is just being elevated here. Mm-hmm. And it's there was that quote the developer said, oh, if Octopath Traveler succeeds, we're going to make more games.
Yeah, they always say that shit.
Like, what does that mean? Like, first of all, you know it's going to do okay. Is it?
Yeah.
Is it going to do okay? It's going to do okay.
Yeah, it'll do well.
I mean, it's a big, beefy game. And if you want a big, beefy game, whether it's, you know, super substantial or not, it sure does have a lot of beef.
I think people will be disappointed, though.
I think a lot of people will.
Because I don't think it's what people expect. I think people expect this grand, great adventure, and it's really not that. It's 8 different stories that are all just kind of okay, and there's nothing really. The only thing that kept me going and kept me interested throughout the entire 36 hours I spent with the game was the battle system.
Yeah. So we were saying anecdotally, conversationally, and also I said in my video a lot that it's pretty much a saga game.
Yes.
It's very much a saga game.
But not as good.
Yeah, not as good, but also not, you know, saga's got some of these, there are things with saga that you have to really love it to like it.
Well, also, in saga games, you play one story at a time. You don't alternate.
That's true.
And alternating has this, like, I don't know, it has this whiplash where you're like, wait a minute, who is that NPC? I haven't seen them since 3 chapters ago because I just did all the other chapter 2s. And it just does not work. The storytelling structure they chose just does not work at all because, look at Saga Frontier. That's a really perfect comparison because it's very similar. In Saga Frontier, you have 7 stories and you pick them all from a loading screen one at a time, and each one is kind of self-contained, but and it's in the same world. There are a lot of overlapping characters and settings and all that stuff. But the way it works is that for each of those seven stories, that character will get some of his own specific party members to join. Like when you go as the robot dude, he comes with other robot friends to join him and interact with him. And the game knows that you have these characters in your party, so it'll tell the story accordingly. In this, since your only party is the eight people who each have their own stories, the game has no way of knowing, really, or they didn't design it to account for all the different permutations of your party. So instead, it's just like, oh, this is your one story. Okay, we're just going to focus on this character. Nobody else matters here.
So you can't take your first chosen protagonist out of the party.
Right, until you finish that protagonist story.
Then
it's unlocked.
So then you can just take them out whenever you want.
Yeah.
Okay. So
what happened, the way it works
I didn't know that, but that's actually like, that feels like, if you're hearing this and that feels to you like that's a spoiler, it's really frustrating when you learn you can't take your main character out.
Yeah, no.
It's like the first time I was like, I love Tressa, she's my favorite. And then I'm like, well, I'm going to take her out for this dungeon because someone else would be better suited to it. And it's like, no, you can't do that, man. You made a choice. It's like, that's the only time they bring the hammer of choice down on you. They're like, no, you made a choice. You can't go back on it. And it's like, oh, I really, the game's not taking itself, its own structure seriously enough for that choice to feel anything, you know, other than
arbitrary.
Yeah, it feels arbitrary.
It is totally arbitrary. And the only reason they did it, I assume, is so they would have one story that would be like the official end. And then when that ends, the credits roll. And then you can just take them out of your party. And that's the only difference.
So there's no real, like, there's no real incentive to have more than one save file.
Correct. There's no need to.
So, but is there, you know, let's flip that. Is there an incentive to have to get everything on one save file? Is there, if you get all eight, does something happen?
I don't know. So as of right now, so I finished all eight stories. Nothing new happened as far as I could tell. There might be something. There's been a lot of buzz on the internet about questions of like, is there some final epilogue or something like that, which would make sense, I guess.
It feels like some
of the stories have been hinting at some sort of connections. There are definitely connections between the stories. Like, you'll see similar threads and themes and characters mentioned. But unless there's some super hidden esoteric way to activate that, which I have not found yet, then there is nothing like that. Because the way it works is, as you saw on the map, you look at this world map and you'll see exactly where each chapter, each next chapter is. So it'll be like this little icon here for Ulbrich Chapter 2 or whatever. After you beat all of them, there's just no more icons on the map. And so I spent a bunch of time just poking around in different places trying to see if I could find anything new, but no, nothing.
Using all your party actions on every possible NPC?
I haven't tried that yet. I haven't done all the optional stuff. There's a bunch of optional dungeons and bosses and stuff. Some of them are really friggin' hard. So if you're really into the mechanics, you will enjoy going and trying to beat these optional super bosses.
See, I knew before we had this conversation that I was definitely going to sit down and get everything, whether I'm getting paid to do so or not.
Yes.
And now
I'm very
sure I will.
There are four like super classes, jobs that you can get, but you have to beat really tough bosses in order to get them.
I can do it. Here's what I would say. Here's how I think the game should end. They should let you get to a secret level, and then you're required to pick two parties of four, and then do a Final Fantasy VI switch back and forth.
There are a lot of things they should have done.
And then the final boss is a huge evil demon octopus.
It just blows my mind that they thought it was like that people were just going to enjoy a game where you're literally repeating the same exact formula 32 times.
Yeah.
Or 31 times, sorry.
Now, if the story had been exceptionally well written,
then sure, if the stories. And even then, it's like just the idea of you're doing all these stories out of order, and it's so hard to remember exactly because each of the stories introduces tons of new NPCs with each chapter. And it's just so like disjointing and unsettling, and the way it's all just done very poorly, I think. I'm very interested to see how other reviewers have what they thought of this game and if they found it as grindy and repetitive and kind of structured as poorly as I did. All right, any final thoughts before we move on?
Oh man, I have a million final thoughts.
Okay, give them to me.
I like the graphics, some people don't. I think critics are gonna report on the grind. I feel like I have a good bead on what critics are going to think, and I think they're gonna call it grindy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and I mean I guess I could say a million words more, but watch my video.
Watch Tim's video.
It's stupid. I reference like a million games in it. As I tried to reference as many games as I could.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Hey, I'm Melissa Kirsch, editor-in-chief of Lifehacker.
And I'm Alice Bradley, Lifehacker's deputy editor.
And we're the hosts of Lifehacker's podcast, The Upgrade. On The Upgrade, we help you improve your life 1 week at a time. We talk to guests like former hacker Hector Monsegur about online security.
You need to be aware of how you could be attacked. You need to be aware of what's your weakness.
And Alan Alda on how to communicate more effectively.
And in order to achieve that, we start with teaching exercises derived from improvisation.
And sex therapist Steven Snyder about how to have great sex in a long-term relationship.
What really works under those circumstances is if you enjoy the other person selfishly.
Hey, your life? It's terrible. We can help.
Find The Upgrade wherever you get your podcasts.
We don't have a ton more time, but there is one thing that I wanted to talk to you about while I have you here.
Let's talk about whatever we can.
Tim, unlike Kirk, who puts up with my occasional diversions, you are as big a fan of The Sopranos as I am.
I don't know if as big of a fan. I've watched the whole series twice, and I'm currently in the back half of my third viewing of it.
Okay.
So I'm just starting season 5.
Okay, so let's get into some real spoilery, just deep Sopranos chat. So first of all, let me put up, this is a big spoiler warning. So if you're listening to this and you have not watched all of The Sopranos, we'll
you
talk
should.
About all of it, you should turn off this podcast right now.
You haven't watched all of The Sopranos. You've probably watched Breaking Bad, and it's like, why not also have watched The Sopranos, which is so much better.
Oh, yeah, so much better. And especially watching it all marathoning it, you just get such a better experience than watching it live was, because it could be very slow when it was airing live back in the day.
But years between seasons.
Exactly. And also just people got really frustrated with the lack of mob action in some seasons and some episodes, some strings of episodes. But anyway, this is your spoiler warning. Last chance to get out of here. If you have not watched The Sopranos, go watch it. Here, I'll give you 2 seconds to go watch it. 1, 2. All right. Tony dies at the end, first of all.
Oh, you think he dies?
I think he totally dies.
You think he dies?
I think they've been setting it up the entire time.
Didn't our main man David Chase say he doesn't die though?
No, David Chase has been squirrely. He's said all these different things and kept saying like, well, people kept harassing him about it, and he kept saying at first, oh, I don't want to talk about it, I don't want to tell anybody, and then who knows? I saw him say some stupid quote about how like he picked that Journey song, "Don't Stop Believing," because the lyrics were very reflective of what he wanted to say or something. I don't know.
Don't stop believing that Tony's still alive.
Yeah, but I don't want to talk about that question. That question has been discussed to death. I want to talk about the show as a whole. So tell me why. Yeah. Well, first of all, what do you love about The Sopranos?
So I remember it being the first TV show that everyone was like, TV is good, actually.
Actually, right? TV is good. TV, good.
I was a journalism student at Indiana University in Bloomington, Indiana at the time that The Sopranos began airing.
Kirk's hometown.
Kirk Hamilton's hometown. Me and Kirk Hamilton have eaten at the La Charreada restaurant in Bloomington, Indiana together.
Nice.
I had a vegetarian combination E. I'll leave it up to everyone else to imagine what that is. So,
how do you remember that?
Oh, I just it was one of my favorite combinations.
Head full of just random
trivia. I have a sort of a neurological condition where I remember more stuff than a lot of people. I've written 30,000 words about this. If you want to read a novella on the subject of my memory problem, just look up the Just Like Hamburger, Exactly Like Hamburger on medium.com. Mm. Maybe if you can read all of that, you're my friend. So there's that. Bloomington, Indiana, the editor-in-chief, the then editor-in-chief of TV Guide came to give like a lecture series at the journalism school, which first of all, this is pretty fun to think about because it's before blogs, and someone asks like, well, what do you think of, he's like saying something about how TV is going to die, how it's all going to be just what everything you think about what you know about TV is just totally gone.
Uh-huh.
It's all going to have totally changed. It's all going to become reality TV.
Uh-huh.
People, you're going to be seeing more normal people out there. There's going to be blogs. Blogs are going to take over the TV world. Like more people are going to be blogging, and they're going to be hanging out in front of their computers than in front of their TVs. This guy's saying all this stuff in 1999, mm-hmm. right? And it's like, obviously, not too many people are believing him or listening to him because they weren't on the cutting edge just yet. The cutting edge hadn't happened yet.
Uh-huh.
So he's like, just narrative TV is going to be gone. There's going to be no more narrative TV. And then someone's
quite a prediction.
And then someone was like, well, have you seen The Sopranos? And he just goes, oh, come on. That's not TV. That's HBO. And then someone was like, well, is HBO going to be around forever? And he's like, yeah. And then he's like, narrative TV has to become just like HBO or it's going to be gone.
Uh-huh.
And then I guess it did.
It did.
So, you know, hooray.
Yeah, good job. So is that what got you into The Sopranos?
Well, I mean, I'd watched a couple episodes of it at the time, but I was really busy as a student and I didn't get to watch a whole lot of TV. I was one of those people who, you know, was proud of not owning a TV.
Of course.
You know, just like there's still people.
Nowadays, I feel like you just sound like a total dork if you say that. Someone would be like, what? You haven't seen Breaking Bad?
I long for
you
the day.
Seen Game of Thrones?
Oh, God, Game of Thrones. Game of Thrones rules.
Yeah, except for the last season.
It still rules. It's rules in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
It rules if you can still remember. If you can remember every meal you ate when you were 13 years old, Game of Thrones still owns.
Okay.
And that's me.
So only Tim Rogers. It owns for Tim Rogers.
Just me.
Okay.
So it's like, I don't know, what was the question? Yeah, if you say you don't own a TV now, yeah. You're just kind of an idiot.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I heard somebody say that a couple months ago, and then someone's like, well, have you not seen such and such TV show? And this person's like, oh, well, yeah, I mean, I watched it on Netflix, on my computer. It's like, so I guess not owning a TV is a different thing to be proud of now.
Right.
You know, do you encounter people who talk about how one of the things that frustrates me is when someone says, oh, I only read real books. I don't have a Kindle. I read real books. There's still people who say that.
Uh-huh.
It's like, I read books on my phone, you know? And
well, I'm one of those people who only reads physical books, but it's not for any elitist reason. It's just I like
having them in your hand. So I read books on my phone. Looks like this.
Yeah, that looks awesome.
Like, I can read.
For people who, when you say looks like this, you're on a podcast.
I've got iBooks.
So people are just, I'm watching Tim right now scrolling on his phone, and the text is gigantic.
It's large.
Like 15 words.
You can read it from an arm.
Screen.
It's like for the focal length of like an arm's length away, and I can read it. And iBooks on iPhone scrolls at 60 FPS. Mm-hmm. It's really nice and smooth. So it's like, I don't know, I read books. I remember hearing about The Sopranos and being like, oh, this rules. My dad was watching it. Man. And then it wasn't until about 4 years later when I was living in Tokyo. And that's when I torrented it. First of all, I was getting gigabit internet. Gigabit in 2004.
Impressive.
In Tokyo for about like $28 a month or whatever. Okay, that owned really hard. I was able to torrent like every episode of The Sopranos. I was getting them in like pretty reasonable high definition and watching them on my 1080p TV, which I had bought for an exorbitant amount of money. So I watched, I just like bonkered through The Sopranos. I watched like the first four seasons like straight through and had a really good time. And then, yeah. So the way I felt about it was I felt like it's like Russian literature is the way it's structured. It's not structured in a way that is, at the time it was revolutionary because you're not given like every episode doesn't have like this five plot points sort of format where you have all the beats happening every time in every episode. Mm-hmm. There'll be two episodes in a row where no major plot point happens.
Right.
Where nothing major happens in the story.
And it's all just the family just like talking about random shit at the dinner table for a while.
Yeah. And it's like you can, it helps that at this time I had just reread the novel War and Peace for like the second time. It's like that. Mm. It's like War and Peace. I think it's almost as good as War and Peace. Mm. And that's like War and Peace. I don't know. Have you read War and Peace?
I have not.
It has large past. It has many, many characters. It shifts between pacing things very quickly and then taking a long time to just depict a party scene or like a chapter that's one conversation, a chapter that's just Leo Tolstoy as himself speaking directly at you about something involving the politics of the day. And it's just this mixed media project. Tolstoy swore it wasn't a novel. It was something by itself.
An ARG.
It was a book. Yeah, it was an ARG. It was serialized in newspapers and magazines.
It was serial. It was basically serial.
Yeah, so Game of Thrones. No, I almost said Game of Thrones.
No, not Game of Thrones.
Not Game of Thrones.
Yeah, The Sopranos, what I really Sopranos liked about like the structure is that it just kept two big things I like. One is that it kept subverting expectations. So like to bring up specific examples, in season two, it's all about, the whole season is about this dude, Richie Aprile, this hardcore gangster getting out of prison.
Oh, yeah.
Really making life difficult for Tony Soprano and his crew just by being undermining and eventually wanting to take out Tony Soprano. And eventually you get to this episode where Tony finally gives the green light to go whack which Richie Aprile. But before that can even happen, before you get to this epic mob scene, Janice, who is Tony's sister, who is engaged to Richie Aprile at the time, he like gets into a domestic dispute with her and hits her, and she just pulls out a gun and shoots him. And that's how Richie Aprile dies.
She just blows him away.
Yeah. And so The Sopranos kept doing that. It kept subverting your expectations, making you think that it was setting up for some sort of epic showdown and then just like cutting the legs underneath it right away.
I love that stuff. I especially love like what happens with Christopher. I love that Christopher's listening to the Departed soundtrack in his car. So I mean, that's the big thing. That's like I don't know what the fly on the room when this thing was fly on the wall when the show was pitched idea was, but it's like I feel like a gangster who goes to a psychiatrist, like, analyze this. Okay, analyze this gets name dropped in the show.
Yeah, so
it's like,
good.
It's like analyze this, but literature.
Because it was actually pitched before Analyze This, and then people kept bringing up Analyze This, so they brought it up. And
I feel like the pitch must have involved these guys have seen The Godfather. So it's mafia guys love The Godfather.
Yeah, exactly.
And reference it really, really well at interesting times.
Well, because their lives are so kind of mundane. Like, they spend all day, like, shooting pool and talking about boring shit. Like, half of the time in The Sopranos is the mobsters. Like, half of the time we spend with the mobsters and The Sopranos, they're not talking about mob shit. They're talking about, like the best way to do laundry and, like, other random shit.
Yeah, it rules. So it's like, also at this time that Sopranos was on, I took the one creative writing class I've ever taken at Indiana University in Bloomington, Indiana. And I remember on the very first day of class, this the teacher who was had just published a short story collection and was very bitter about it. He had said there the market right now is all about defamiliarization. This is what he literally said. The market right now is all about defamiliarization. This was August of 1999, right? So, first of all, the market, meaning selling a fiction book, is defamiliarization. Take something people think they know, and Batman Begins, right? Batman doesn't train at the circus. He trains with ninjas.
Right.
You defamiliarize it. Well, okay, this was like 6 years before Batman Begins. Batman Begins was the zeitgeist then was to defamiliarize and naturalize.
Okay, I think you're on like a tangent of
That's a tangent. Okay. So yeah, so oh yeah, well we take it right
Let's
back.
Let's take it back. Yeah,
we take it right back. The Sopranos is defamiliarized gangsters.
Right.
Right. So it's defamiliarized, but it's also naturalized.
Right.
So it was way ahead of that particular zeitgeist.
Right.
So
this is not Goodfellas. This is not Joe Pesci just beating everybody up. This is just like normal ass people who happen to be psychopaths.
So it's like the message back then, the market being about defamiliarization and later about naturalization. That was advice that begat a lot of very bad fiction. A lot of very bad literary fiction came out at around that time. And The Sopranos is just kind of a miracle of clarity of mission. Like, they were very clear at what they wanted to do. It's that they wanted to create a story of gangsters who had seen The Godfather and therefore are defamiliarized because they're self-aware in a way characters in The Godfather couldn't have been.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's not gimmicky. It actually has a literary soul.
I think if I remember correctly, the original pitch or one of the original pitches was like, this guy's just like you. He has two kids who are pain in his ass. He has like house mortgage to pay. He has a car. He has a wife who like nags him, whatever, whatever, like cliche shit. Except he also happens to be mob Don, Don of the Mafia. The other thing I was saying before that there are two things I really like about The Sopranos. One is subverting expectations. The other is that the writing is so good because it has a subtlety that really wasn't on TV before. TV for so long was all about just smacking you in the face with all these characters are going to tell you exactly how they feel, tell each other exactly how they feel. The Sopranos was all about characters not saying how they feel because it was all about this idea of like American masculinity and repression, and it was this perfect dissection of the American marriage with Tony and Carmela and how there were so many endings of episodes where it just had this great framing of the two of them sitting in the kitchen.
Like a beautiful slow fade to black.
And they would all, it would always be them next to each other and you, the audience, knowing exactly what they weren't saying to one another, but knowing what they were thinking about and them never actually saying it because it was all about like how real humans interact with one another, which was very different from anything else that was on TV at the time. And even now, it's just so like stands so far above so many other shows. It's just glorious.
It's like just rewatching it now. You know, being aware of what all the big story beats are going to be. Just rewatching it now, I'm really appreciating somehow what I never really appreciated as much before. It's just the rhythm of it's not just that the writing is good, which it is, and it's not just that it's punchy, which it is. It's sometimes it's not punchy, right? Sometimes it's a more natural, frantic kind of sentence, and then sometimes you just get these really good rhythmic punches, and it feels like theater sometimes, and then it feels like a movie sometimes, and then it feels like you're just hanging out with people you know sometimes. Mm-hmm. So it's like that mixture, that rhythm is just something that you don't see at all on TV shows. Now, Mad Men had that. Mad Men had that like sometimes. Mad Men's still my favorite show.
Yeah, I still have to watch that.
Mad Men is, well, if you like the Matthew Weiner episodes of Sopranos.
Which I do.
You giddy up.
I like all the episodes of Sopranos, even the bad ones.
Yeah, I actually can't even think of a bad one.
I think there are a couple of bad ones. One is the one with Jon Favreau.
That one was written by Michael Imperioli.
Yes, Christopher.
Written by Christopher, yeah.
That was kind of a bad one. And then Christopher, the one also written by Michael Imperioli.
Yeah.
Not the greatest. That's the one about Christopher Columbus and like the
that Indian one's
dudes.
Very on the nose, yeah.
Yeah, that one's very, very like, I think at the time it was like a response to all the people in the media saying Sopranos is glorifying, like making Italian-Americans look bad, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So you can see why they did it in the context of that time, but now it's just, it's not. And a couple others, but obviously most of them, even a bad episode of The Sopranos is so much better than any other TV show.
Yeah, it's still framed and shot and just rhythmed.
And you still get to
so
hang
well.
Out with The Sopranos. And also there were some really bad, like the show went on some really bad diversions, like when they introduced Meadow's roommate in college, Caitlin.
Oh, yeah.
That was just some really bad
she's
stuff.
Just not handling college very well.
Yeah, it's just like, why are we here? What are we doing here?
In that episode, they show the clock in Union Square.
That's true.
At one point.
That's true. Yeah. And they show the Virgin store, which is no longer there.
Yeah, that was incredible. I've
rest
actually
in peace.
Never saw that in person.
You missed out. All right, Tim, we have to wrap things up.
Oh, yeah.
It is time for us to go. Before we say goodbye, is there anything you would like to plug? Obviously, people can find you on Kotaku.com.
Yeah.
What else can they find?
God, I don't know. I'm on Twitter. I'm 108 on Twitter.
Why?
Because I love old Chinese literature.
No. I meant, why are you on Twitter?
Oh, why am I on Twitter? Oh, God, I don't know. I'm on there because people keep following me, and then I just figured I have to. I tweet about Tarzan a lot lately. I've been rereading all the Tarzan
Follow Tim
books.
Rogers at 108 for Tarzan tweets, and people can, of course, find your games online, Video Ball, wherever.
Yeah. Truck Heck is coming at some point.
Truck Heck is coming at some point.
I think Kotaku.com will have the exclusive on Truck Heck, if you know what I mean.
Oh, man. Going to give it to us?
I'm generous of you. I'm going to stream myself playing it.
Nice. Beautiful. Well, people will be able to see that soon. And Tim, people will be able to watch your Octopath Traveler video probably just around when this episode goes live.
Yeah, I got two little videos.
Cool. All right, Tim, thank you so much for coming on the show. And I will be back next week with Kirk Hamilton, back to our regular podcasting schedule.
Kirk Hamilton will be back.
All right. Goodbye, Tim.
Bye.
Kotaku Split Screen is an official podcast of Kotaku.com. It's produced by Jason Schreier and me, Kirk Hamilton. I edit and mix the podcast and also wrote and performed our theme song and other music. We're part of the Fusion Podcast Network, where Mandana Mofidi is executive producer of audio. You can find us on popular podcast services like Panoply, NPR Now, Google Play, and Apple Podcasts, and we hope that you'll leave us a review if you like what you hear. Find old episodes at Kotaku.com/splitscreen. Email us at splitscreen@Kotaku.com.